The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
If you aren't turned around on it,
then I'm kicked off the show.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
You're serious, aren't you? You're telling us you killed those three young men on the subway?
Mm-hmm.
And why should we believe you?
I got nothing left to lose. Nothing can hurt me anymore. My life is nothing but a comedy.
Hello, everybody. It's episode Wreckatopia. Oh, episode Wreckatopia. There we go. It is Wreckatopia, episode 124. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Jokerinos.
That's right. I'd like to also welcome chat. Thank you for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on finally a Tuesday again. It's been a rough go there on those Thursdays, man. Those Thursdays have been bad.
Oh, never could get the hang of Tuesdays.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm going to start us off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Do it.
Okay, so some buddies and I have this monthly movie night thing, and the guy who chose the movies chose a Cary Grant double feature, which is just so happens to be my two small recommends today. One is a movie I had never seen. It's called Only Angels Have Wings. It's a Howard Hawks movie from 1939, and this is about Cary Grant owns like a plane delivery company, like a bunch of pilots he employs and everything like that, and this movie is kind of episodic. It's not like one overarching plot going on here, but we get the sense that this business can be pretty dangerous because they are flying planes in, I think it's like Colombia or something, South America, somewhere around there. And they have to do a variety of jobs. And one of the first jobs we see, one of the first people that we see go up in a plane, goes up into a fog and gets a little bit too cocky about his skills in the fog. And he ends up crashing the plane, and dies. And then how do we move on? Well, Cary Grant seems to be just kind of like, well, that's the way things go around here. That's what you do. And besides, I've got another pilot coming in, who can take his job and everything. So everything is just sort of like, let's move on. And we don't have time to reflect on any of these things. Meanwhile, he has a love interest who has come in. They were supposed to only come in for like a weekend or whatever, but she ends up staying because she's suddenly just falling in love with Cary Grant. That's Jean Arthur. That's in the thumbnail that we have down here, if you can see this. There's this kind of like, well, I don't know if they're really ever going to get together type of thing, because the life of a pilot and everything is just too much. But I really love this movie, man. There's a performance here from Thomas Mitchell, who a lot of you know as Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life. I had seen him in a couple of things. I've seen him in It's a Wonderful Life. I saw him in Stagecoach, and in both of them, he's kind of a drunken character or kind of an over the top character. This one is a little bit more straight laced, and it is a great performance. And he's a pilot who is losing his vision, and there's a point where Cary Grant has to decide whether or not to let him go, because he's, you know, when you're a pilot, you need very good vision. But anyway, this movie is really, 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 really good. I highly recommend it. I had never heard of it before. And so, especially if you're trying to complete a Howard Hawks retrospective, this is a good one.
I look forward to seeing it. I searched for it yesterday to see if maybe I could get it in before the show, and I couldn't find it streaming anywhere, so I wasn't able to check it out. But I'm going to find a way to snag this and see it, because, yes, the director, Howard Hawks, is that right?
Yeah.
And then just Cary Grant at this era was just... I mean, he was so charismatic on screen.
Yeah.
And I mean, every era he has that charisma.
Yeah.
It's not like he ever really lost it.
It goes on forever.
But,
yeah.
I'll save another Cary Grant point for your next small recommend. But but yeah, I really am excited to see this.
And it's funny, Shaggy Nuts says, sounds like a Wings episode. I made that exact joke while we were watching this movie. Because it does feel like a Wings episode. But it came out way before, and it's got more heft and dynamics, man.
Josh in the chat says, is this the source of the Get Out GIF? And no, it is not. His Girl Friday is where that comes from. So just let you know that. All right. My first small recommend is a movie that just came out recently called I Used to Be Funny. This is available on VOD. I don't think it's made it to any of your streaming services yet. Rachel Sennett might be how you pronounce her last name. But I have really, really enjoyed her performances and the things that I've seen her in. I find her to be captivating and funny and a really interesting actor.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the centerpiece here in a story about a stand-up comedian who is also an au pair for a family. Au pair used to be what is now what nannies are called. And so she's taking care of the daughter of a family whose mom died. And some things happen in this family that I don't want to give away, because the movie does a really good job of presenting that information to you when it's time to have it. But some things go on with this to where there is a breaking between her and the daughter that she had been caring for in such a traumatic way that it completely kills her ability to function in life and to be funny and to be a comedian and those kind of things. This movie feels really naturalistic, really authentic. I bought into every piece of it, and it touches on some really deep and interesting topics. And I think it's a really valuable watch and a good watch. I really, really liked I Used to Be Funny. So yeah, that's one to check out.
Yeah, I like her a lot too. She sort of like made an announcement with that Bodies performance.
Yeah.
And she's followed that up pretty well. I don't think she's a household name yet, because we are still trying to figure out if it's Sennett or Sennott.
Right. I think it's Sennett, but I don't know.
Yeah. But
did you see Shiva Baby?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, yeah. That's another one in her. I think that may have been her first. 2020. Really worth a watch. It's a horror movie that has no horror elements.
Oh, if that nice.
It's interesting. It's just like,
now I'm interested completely. And what did Aaron mean by that?
That's right. That's right.
Another movie in the Cary Grant double feature was The Awful Truth, which I had seen a couple of times. And this makes a great compliment, by the way, to His Girl Friday, since we've already mentioned that. And we also did a review of or did a recommend on that one a while back when we were doing the decades, comedy decades and everything. But this was also in consideration for the 1930s, The Awful Truth. It's Cary Grant also stars Ralph Bellamy, which is sort of another thing about it. It has in common with His Girl Friday. The woman in this one is Irene Dunne. This is about a couple who at the very beginning, there's kind of a misunderstanding, which I will say to the movie's credit, they never fully like give a total explanation for it, because it could still be what Cary Grant thinks it is, and it could still be what Irene Dunne thinks it is. But there's a point where he has gone home with some friends, and Irene Dunne walks in with I can't remember if it's a piano teacher or whatever, but that's it's scandalous because there's already this thought that maybe she was cheating on him with the piano teacher or the music teacher or whatever. But she insists, no, that's not what happened. You know, her car broke down. They had to go to a motel, blah, 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 blah. And this distrust leads to them finally getting a divorce right at the beginning of the movie. But there's a time limit on this thing. I guess they have 60 days or something like that to before this divorce takes place. In the meantime, Irene Dunne meets Ralph Bellamy, and Ralph Bellamy, of course, is the unsuitable suitor, as he plays in His Girl Friday. But during all this time where Cary Grant and Irene Dunne are both sort of like pretending like this divorce is the best thing for them, and they're going off to meet other people and dating other people and everything, there's an undeniable chemistry between the two of them as they get together. And there's a hilarious moment in this movie where Ralph Bellamy takes Irene Dunne out to the dance floor, and it's clear that he wants to dance and she does not, and she is not. She's kind of like just going through the motions. Watching Cary Grant's expressions during this, he even gets up from the table and pulls up a chair and to get a better seat to see her struggle on the dance floor is a great moment in this movie. It's just there's a lot of like great crackling comedy dialogue in this movie. This is what you want to see when you have the screwball comedy and everything like that. And it's got a lot of just different misunderstandings and farces and things like that that go on in it. Well worth the watch if you've never seen it. I've seen it like 3 or 4 times now. It's a great movie.
Was my first watch yesterday when I watched this, and I was so glad I did. This is on the Criterion Channel, if you have that and want to check it out there. I love Cary Grant in this movie, and Dunne is amazing too. So talented and so fun, and just has a real charisma of her own and spark, and they're really good together. I had so much fun with this movie. It's just like you said, the dialogue is fun. The scenes are fun. It's wild to me that a lot of this, I guess, was improvised in some of the stuff I was looking at, which speaks to, I think, the natural sense of humor of these actors. I had a really good time. I couldn't help but think, and this is the point I was thinking earlier about Cary Grant, about how much his early career feels like Ryan Reynolds to me. Like, I can, like, a lot of the way he's doing comedy in this movie and some of his early comedies feels like that smirky kind of
self-aware.
Self-aware, but still has charisma. Like, there's a really interesting aspect to it. Now, the interesting thing is it kind of evolves to be more George Clooney in some ways. Like, there's a more suave charisma as his career goes on that leaves a little bit of the boyishness behind that you'll see in some of this stuff. Cary Grant is just such a presence on screen, and I'm always glad to see a movie of his I haven't checked out because he's so fun. And this movie is also about marriage, which is really, really interesting because, you know, I don't think it's giving anything away to say that the awful truth is that they still love each other. That's the awful truth.
Yes.
Is that even wanting to get a divorce, they still love each other. I don't know. I found it all affecting and beautiful. So, this is a good one for sure.
Yep.
Let's see. My second small recommend is a documentary on Hulu called The Contestant. This has been out for a little while.
Oh, I know about this story. I haven't seen this movie, but...
So a lot of people know this story because it was big in the news for a little bit about this Japanese game show a while back where they had a contestant who had to live off of only prizes they could win from magazines. They're trapped in a room and have to win prizes from magazines, and then they would broadcast this on like a... it wasn't its own show. It was part of like this other variety show, but there was a segment and it blew up and everybody loved this guy. And his name translates in Japanese to eggplant, which just an amazing little piece of internet possible history. When he was on the show, he was nude because they took away all his clothes, but they would cover his genitals with the image of an eggplant because that's what his name means in Japanese. And it many people believe that's where that emoji started being used as male genitalia was from this movie. And the timeline kind of works, or not movie, but from this, you know, segment on the show. And that's fascinating to me. I love like those little kind of things. What this documentary does is it goes into detail with direct interviews with both the contestant and the producer who was mostly and almost solely responsible for this idea and this execution. And to hear their varying perspectives and narratives on what happened, what it was, it is clear the contestant feels abused, used, tortured, like, you know, didn't know what was going on, didn't understand. He literally went from a room of a bunch of people who were, like, I forget, there was some sort of drawing of, you know, numbers or something, and whoever drew the number was part of it. Literally goes from that drawing to a room, has his clothes taken from him, and is, you know, told what to do. And they played with his emotions in really big ways. There's some turns that this story takes that I was not ready for because I again had heard of the overall story but didn't know the details. And the details are very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting how they, in this documentary, take this story of trauma and find the hope in it. And it's valuable to see where this contestant ended up in what they ended up doing with their life after this traumatic experience. So so this is a recommend for sure. It is on Hulu. It's been there for a bit.
I can't remember what the success rate was of his magazine thing was. It was something absurdly low, like out of every 1,000, he'd get 14 wins or something like that. And of course he's hoping to get food most of the time. That's just the reality of where he's at. And then there was a point too, where I think that he needed to get $100,000 of stuff or something like that, and he'd be done with the game. Mm-hmm. But then they increased it arbitrarily because they were making way too much money on the show to stop it all of a sudden. So yeah, I definitely want to see this because I'm sure I have not heard some of the to get some more detail on all of this. I've heard two different YouTube channels talk about this game show, but I'm sure that there's some more information that I haven't heard. So.
Well, and again, part of the draw is to hear it from his own lips too. You know what I mean? To hear like him talk about these things and the more fascinating stuff sometimes is from the producer who kind of still feels like he would do it all over again. You know what I mean? Like I think he's aware of the trauma he caused, but he will also say things like, I created one of the best moments in the history of television, and as if that is some greater goal. So it's I don't know. Human nature is fascinating.
How that happens, by the way. Like you're in a traumatic experience, and they're like, "Yeah, I'll do that again." Like they did that with it was the Woodstock '99, I believe. It was two documentaries about that. I can't remember, but there was in one of them. They're talking about this one girl who's like 14, and of course there's like all sorts of the most heinous shit going on at Woodstock 99, and she didn't feel safe and all that. And now she's 20 years later. She's like, I would have done that again.
Yeah. I'm
like, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, that is interesting as well. And just to be clear what I was talking about, the producer was saying they would do it all over again.
Oh,
put
they
them
would
through
do it again.
This
okay.
all over again. The contestant... No,
okay, contestant, not.
Not.
Okay,
not
good.
At all
right, yes,
not
good,
at
good
all.
Clarification because that's what I thought you said for a second. All right. Now we're going to go on to our big recommend.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, you know, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. And additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And it is 2019's Joker, Todd Phillips, doing something different with his resume. He had been doing nothing but comedies and hangover movies and Road Trip and stuff like that, and now he's doing a serious foray into a comic book movie. So this is a movie once again. This is part of a series, and I think we're going to kind of not end it forever next week, but we're going to stop doing it for a while after next week, because there's plenty more that I could do with this. But this is yet another in the series of movies that have like very high ratings on the IMDb or, a lot of awards, a lot of people telling you it's great, that I have never been able to get into. And Aaron is also a part of this group for Joker. So is it possible that this viewing over the weekend, turned me around on it? Stay tuned. Let's go to the synopsis. The opening news position tells us it's October 15th, day 18 of the garbage strike, with 10,000 tons of garbage piling up every day. And even the nicer parts of towns, look like slums. Could the literal garbage be a metaphor for human hatred and crime? Probably. The camera moves in on a solitary figure applying clown makeup in a mirror, who we will later learn is Arthur, played by Joaquin Phoenix. He works at basically a temp agency for clowns, and his job today is working as a sign spinner for a music store that's going out of business. Some kids make fun of him, knock his sign out of his hands, and steal it for the lulz. A foot chase ensues and ends with Arthur getting beaten up by those same kids, and the sign ends up destroyed. Cut to the man out of his makeup, where he is uncontrollably laughing in a way that is actually crying. Is it just me, or is it getting crazier out there? He asks his social worker. She sympathizes, then asks for a journal he's promised to write in every day. The journal is a mixture of thoughts, pornographic images, and a list of jokes he wants to tell as a stand-up comedian. We find out he used to be locked up in a hospital for something he either doesn't remember or doesn't want to admit. He wants to up the dose on his medications, but we find out he's on 7 different ones. On a bus, he entertains a kid with goofy faces, only to be told by the kid's mom to stop bothering him. So even when he does something positive, he's getting shit on for it. And then he laughs uncontrollably, and this kind of reaction isn't understood, so he produces a handy card in his pocket that tells people that he has a medical condition that causes it, and please forgive him. As if his life isn't bad enough, the final stop of his bus ride makes him walk forever, leading to a giant stairway he must climb up before getting to his apartment, where he lives with his mom, Penny, played by Frances Conroy. They settle in to watch late-night talk show host Murray Franklin, played by Robert De Niro. During the show, Arthur imagines himself in the audience, where he yells out how much he loves Murray, who singles him out in the audience as someone truly special. Murray tells the audience that he and Arthur have a lot in common. Murray even asks him to come on stage, and when they go to commercial break, he tells him he even wishes he could be Arthur's dad. We cut to Arthur's gaunt and bruised figure in the dressing room from the beginning of the movie, where the Yellow King shows him sympathy for what he went through the other day and hands him a gun. Shortly after, he's summoned to the boss's office, where he is told the music store is none too pleased about him disappearing the other day and not bringing the sign back, suggesting Arthur never even went back to tell the music store or his boss what happened. When Arthur explains what happened, his boss doesn't believe him and tells him that the cost of the sign is coming out of his paycheck. Arthur smiles through the pain as his boss tells him nobody likes him. Back at the apartment, a woman named Sophie, played by Zazie Beetz, and her daughter catch the elevator before the door closes. The elevator stops at one point, and there appears to be a bit of a bonding moment where Sophie pretends to fake shoot herself in the head when her kid is being a kid. Arthur, not realizing context is everything, waits until they are almost all the way back to their apartments to repeat the gesture back to her, even holding his gaze until she finally opens the door and walks in. There's a discussion between Arthur and Betty about Thomas Wayne, who Betty used to work for. Betty believes that if Wayne were to find out they were living in squalor, he'd fix the problem. After that, he talks about wanting to be a stand-up comedian, and his mom asks, "Don't you need to be funny to do that?" Cosplaying as Rupert Pupkin gives away to cosplaying as Travis Bickle as he waves a gun around during a musical. He accidentally fires the gun and has to lie to his mom about the gunshot she heard. Then we see him at a comedy club laughing inappropriately at the stand-up comic while he takes notes, notes that analyze jokes on a mere surface level. Soon after, he's visited by Sophie at his apartment. She seems to have enjoyed the stalking, which should be the first clue this isn't happening. On to a children's hospital where things go swimmingly until Arthur's gun falls out of his costume, which is a big no-no. They'll fire you for that shit. And they do. On the train back, some assholes harass a woman while Arthur in his clown makeup laughs uncontrollably. They converge on him and give him a beatdown similar to the one earlier in the film, only this time he can pull out a gun and start shooting. But it's not just self-defense as one of them gets away and Arthur hunts the last man down after he gets off the train. Arthur then runs to a random bathroom and does a "My character has changed" dance. He goes home and knocks on Sophie's door, planting a kiss on her as soon as she opens it. With breakneck speed, Arthur is cleaning out his locker the next day, accusing Randall of giving him the gun that got him fired. Arthur's subway killings apparently are huge news in a city full of crime, and it appears it's because the media wants to paint it as an anti-rich sentiment, with poor people believing the killer is the hero. Thomas Wayne agrees, and he's apparently running for mayor now, and he finds it disappointing that people with so little are targeting others with so much. But it also appears that Arthur's making up some of Thomas's words in his head. Who knows? The movie decides to go in this direction when it might be making its most salient point. Nonetheless, Arthur is visibly shaken at the mischaracterization of the crime he committed and Thomas Wayne's words, which seem to be mocking him and his mother. A final straw to Arthur's deterioration is that he won't even be able to get therapy anymore because of a lack of funding and his social worker gets fired. He won't even be able to get his medication anymore. Yes, it seems that citywide, the people in power are failing everyone who needs help. Next up, Arthur tries his stand-up routine, and it's about as bad as you can imagine. A laughing fit where he can barely get a joke out, and when he does, it seems very copy-paste from other things he's heard. Sophie is there for support. I have no idea if any of this is happening, and it's pretty clear what's happening afterwards isn't happening, because they run by some newspapers with headlines about the subway murders, and Sophie says whoever did that is a hero. Arthur notices a cab where one of the passengers is wearing a clown mask. He believes it's a tribute to his good work. When he gets home, Mom has a very important letter she wants Arthur to send to Thomas Wayne. He opens it, and he finds out that his mother believes Thomas is Arthur's father. Arthur confronts his mom, who tells him the truth. She apparently signed a non-disclosure agreement about it. Arthur is now motivated to visit Thomas himself and goes to Wayne Manor. He sees a young Bruce behind the wall, and you don't have to look too closely to see a giant shoehorn in the background. Arthur attempts to impress the kid with some magic tricks. He forcibly puts a smile on Bruce's face before Alfred comes in to break this creepy shit up. Alfred assures Arthur that there was nothing between Thomas and his mom. But that's exactly what he would say, isn't it? Arthur nearly strangles Alfred and then runs away. When he gets back, it looks like his mom has had a stroke. At the hospital, two detectives, played by Bill Camp and Shea Whigham, confront Arthur. They were apparently asking Arthur's mom questions about the subway killings when she had the stroke. They have good reason to interview him because they know someone dressed as a clown did it, and Arthur recently got fired for bringing a gun to work. They also know he laughs uncontrollably, which is another aspect of the killer they're looking for. While he spends time with his mother in her room, Murray Franklin is on the TV and he shares a videotape from a comedy club that has Arthur's terrible stand-up routine on it. Arthur quickly becomes upset that Murray is turning him into a national laughingstock. A joke. A joker? Arthur then sneaks his way past a Wayne protest and into a theater playing Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times and puts on an Usher outfit. He walks into the auditorium where a bunch of rich assholes enjoy being rich assholes, and then notices the richest asshole of them all going to the bathroom, where Arthur quickly runs to meet him. He confronts Thomas about him banging his mom, but Thomas says he's adopted and his mom was committed to Arkham Asylum. When Arthur uncontrollably laughs, Thomas punches him in the face and warns him about coming near his son again. After closing himself in a refrigerator for God knows how long, we cut to the next morning where Murray Franklin's booker is trying to contact him. His stand-up was a hit, for the wrong reason, but still a hit. He books an appearance. Arthur goes to Arkham where he's requested files on his mother from 30 years ago. The assistant, who is paperboy from Atlanta, tells him that his mother was sent here because she endangered her own child. Arthur steals the file from the assistant's hands. He runs into a stairwell and reads it, and may or may not be making up the story that Thomas Wayne made it look like Penny was crazy and that she adopted the kid that was clearly his. She was sent to Arkham because her boyfriend was abusing Arthur. Arthur walks into Sophie's apartment and she clearly does not understand why he's here and barely knows who he is. And so none of that girlfriend stuff even happened. The movie quickly gives us a Fight Club montage of all the times Tyler Durden wasn't there. Arthur goes back to the hospital and lays grievances on his mother for lying to him, suffocates her with a pillow, and gets back to the apartment just in time to practice his Murray Franklin appearance. He also practices putting a gun to his head during the interview. He dyes his hair green, and there's more dancing in a bathroom and applies his clown makeup. Randall and Gary stop by because Randall is interested in getting their story straight for the detectives since he gave him the gun. Arthur then kills the fuck out of Randall with scissors and severely beats him while Gary watches. And I swear to God, Arthur looks like the dude in the Gautier video right after that. Now you're just somebody I used to know, apparently. He lets Gary go. The movie's got little person jokes to tell when Gary can't reach the chain on the lock to go out. To top off the pleasantness, the movie plays Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part 2. Hey, 1981, they didn't know he was a monster, so let's play it in this movie from 2019 and remember the time when we were clueless. Arthur dances down the giant steps in the movie's most iconic scene. The detectives show up at the top of the stairs and chase him into the subway, where it appears everyone is taking on a Joker look these days. Arthur creates chaos by taking a mask off of one of the riders, who pushes him into another rider, who takes umbrage in a full-blown Old West bar fight breaks out. Arthur puts the mask over his makeup and blends in. Eventually, the riders all rebel against the detectives and beat them down. Now on to the Murray Franklin show, where Arthur waits in the green room. Franklin's right-hand man, Mark Maron, thinks putting this guy on TV and giving him a platform is ludicrous and dangerous, but Murray thinks it'll be okay. Arthur now wants to be known as Joker, because that's what Murray called him when he was making fun of him. Murray introduced him as Joker on the show, and thus Joker is born. During the interview, Murray makes fun of him in a manner that is oddly like Joaquin Phoenix's appearance on David Letterman. Murray asks him to tell jokes, and he pulls out his joke book. He tells a terrible knock-knock joke that is funny to him because of his new perspective. He is quickly admonished for joking about something terrible. He then admits he's the one who killed the three assholes on the subway, and he thinks it's funny and is tired of pretending it's not. He goes on to lecture the audience about comedy being subjective and that he killed those people because they were shitty, not to start a movement. That said, Joker now explains that everyone is a hypocrite for being upset about these three people when they don't shed a tear for anyone Thomas Wayne doesn't vouch for. He then accuses Murray for being out of touch as well. Murray lectures Joker about his deeds and how he has no excuses to hide behind. Now Joker explains that he knows Murray made him the butt of a joke. And then he tells him one final joke. What do you get when you cross a mentally ill loner with a society that abandons him and treats him like trash? And the punchline is, you get what you deserve. And he pulls out a gun and kills Murray. He just sits there taking it in while the audience runs out of the studio. Joker is arrested, and during the drive to jail, he notices the crazies rioting everywhere, and he genuinely laughs this time. A Joker minion in an ambulance crashes into the cop car, and more of his followers remove him from it. The Waynes are out having a night on the town, watching the double feature of Blowout and Zorro the Gay Blade, and walk out. If you've ever seen a Batman movie before, you know what happens next. But it's one of the minions killing Bruce's parents here, and not Joker himself. Joker finds himself Christ-like on the hood of a cop car and soaks in the adulation from his followers. It only took a few publicized murders for Arthur to finally become accepted by a large swath of society. He uses the blood on his mouth to paint the famous scar smile on his face. Cut to Arthur at Arkham, laughing while a social worker takes notes. He's laughing because he's thinking of a joke, which the movie implies is Thomas and Martha Wayne getting murdered while helpless Bruce stares in disbelief. The movie then implies he kills the social worker and he escapes. More dancing, and the movie ends with Joker being chased around the hospital. Aaron, what did you think on this turn through Joker?
Still terrible. I may like this movie even less now, paying closer attention. I don't know. I know this movie has many, many people who love it. And so I did try to watch with those eyes and find some things to admire. Mm-hmm. One thing I continue to admire is Joaquin Phoenix's performance. I think he is embodying this character in a disturbing and athletic way that kind of blows my mind.
Yes.
You know, the scene with the fridge dancing down the stairs. There's a reason he won the award. He did win, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he won that Oscar.
Yeah, he did. And it was one of the weirdest Oscar acceptance speeches ever, too.
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason, because he is just absolutely astonishing in this. I also think the art design is really good in this movie. The way colors are used here, the way the clown makeup is used, and there's some real filmmaking skill at work in some of these shots, and specifically in my mind, the color palette and the way things are coming together. If I were to pick out one scene where I was like, maybe this scene in a different movie might be, great. And I think it's because this scene in kind of has a tone to it that the rest of the movie I don't feel like has. It's the scene where he's practicing his entrance for the late night show.
Yeah.
I really like that scene. There's something that scene is saying about this character, his practicing these skills. And when Joaquin comes out and is this version of the suave person who comes out on a late show and waves to the crowd, but we know he's mimicking something he's seeing on TV and there's turmoil inside. Like, there's a tone there that's a little elevated from the rest of the movie for me that I think I could get into if the rest of the movie had a little bit more of that tone. Now, it would have to fix plenty of other things for me to enjoy the movie as well, but there is something in that scene that I found myself going, okay, all right. Like, I'm enjoying is a weird word, but I'm kind of into what we're doing in this scene. I think the biggest problem I have remains the fact that this movie is connected to the Batman universe. I think it ruins the movie in several different ways. Mm-hmm. And that might be an interesting thing to say about a movie that is a Joker origin story. But I think anytime somebody wants to have a conversation with me or make a point to me about this movie and what it has to say about mental illness and what it has to say about our current culture and those kind of things, it is hard for me to take that part authentically and seriously when Bruce Wayne is in this movie and this character has contextual attachments to our pop culture understanding, right? Like there's already a weight of something on this character that this movie can't erase. And nor does it want to, because it's embracing those connections. It's not like, maybe this is the real Joker. Maybe it's not. No, this is the Joker. Like he takes the name, he meets with the Waynes, he has those connections. Like it is what is going on here. So it just makes it so difficult to understand what we're trying to do here when we talk about mental illness the way we talk about mental illness in the way in this movie. And I just think that's really disconcerting. I think it's really off-putting to me and makes it really difficult to watch. There are some scenes that seem to me to want to really linger in the evil of it all. And I get that that's probably the point. Specifically, I'm thinking of the scene where he kills the one guy but lets the other guy go. Just wants to dance in that violence. And it's, I don't know. I just don't think it's necessary. I don't understand if that is the point, which it seems to be, what we're trying to do with that, what we're trying to say. We get it. Like, you know, he suffocates his mom. Like we know the level of depravity and turmoil that's going on inside this character. Do we need to live to see this? And then almost, maybe I'm bringing this to this, but almost delight in the tension of, is he going to do it to the little person as well? And like there's almost like an energy excitement there, and that seems to be conveyed. And I don't know, this movie hits me wrong so much of the time. I guess the one other thing I mentioned, I know I'm ranting about a lot of this stuff. I just really don't like this movie. But the movie also feels really false in places. For instance, all of the stuff, and this is before you start talking about what's real and what's not, which I actually think the movie is pretty clear on. I actually don't think that's very confusing. I think that the movie is clear that all the Zazie Beetz stuff was, you know, made up in his mind, aside from the first interaction in the elevator, and the rest of the stuff is real. But there's some things that just, like, for instance, when the idea that he would do this bad set at a comedy club and then it would get picked up by a late night show as something they would show is do you know how many bad comedy club sets there are every day? And do you know how many late show hosts come from the comedy world, and it would be against everything in their essence to make fun of somebody who's struggling because they all know everybody bombs. Every single comedian, you know, it's...
Well, and it takes an internet era cynicism to say that that's something that would get picked up on a show like that. And I think he's ostensibly doing a Johnny Carson / you know, David Letterman kind of guy here. By the way, not to interrupt and start going off on a rant of my own.
Go for it.
But Robert De Niro does not work as a talk show host at all. I don't understand how he's popular. He's not Carson, that's for sure, and definitely not Letterman. I don't know where I started because I went on two different tangents there. But anyway, proceed.
Yeah. So this whole moment actually, to me, symbolizes in many ways the inauthenticity that I feel in some of this stuff. Even when Murray says, "Check out this Joker," you know, like there's a weird emphasis on that word that just you know, I don't know, I didn't like it. But just the idea that not only would they pick that up, but it would be some kind of big enough hit that they would call the person and have them on the show. Like it's just, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And it seems so forced. And again, A lot of that forcedness is the requirement to tie this to an origin story of a character we already have context for. And the other part of it is it negates so much of the context we have for that character, too. The idea that the Joker is called that because of these things and not because he suffered a grievous facial injury that made it seem like he was smiling all the time is such a different origin story than everything that's ever been done for this character. Like, it just to me smells a lot of trying to force square pegs in round holes to, you know, do something interesting. I love big swings. I really do. This is certainly a big swing. And that's about the nicest thing I can say about it, probably.
Yeah. I have only a few other notes, on this. I do think Joaquin Phoenix is great. You were talking about different things he does in this. There's two other things in here that I want to point out. I love his posture and his demeanor when he is imagining himself in that audience, and he tells the audience, "My mom said I was put here to bring happy smiles to people's faces," and he's got this kind of like nervous, but I'm confident in that this is something that would win an audience over look on his face. That's hard to sort of. There's a lot of stuff going on in just a simple expression that he puts on his face that I think is great. I also love how he's shaking during that Thomas Wayne interview and everything. His legs are just uncontrollably shaking during that entire thing, where you can see the anger boiling in him throughout the whole thing. So there is no doubt that, if you're going to find positives with this movie, it starts with Joaquin Phoenix. I also want to say the score, which in some places echoes the Hans Zimmer, from the Dark Knight trilogy. It is from an Icelandic composer who I've seen before. I do not know how to pronounce her name, and I'm not going to try to, but, that score is really, really well done. So I will give that to this movie as well. This is a general observation. I don't know if it's negative or positive. I don't think the movie thinks Joker is a hero. I think it believes that people will consider Joker a hero in a society that fails its less fortunate. All the safeguards fail when someone like Arthur slips through the cracks. The result is a Joker. If Arthur kills homeless people, he never becomes a celebrity. But I'm trying to decide why I don't connect to this as much as other people do. And I think it's because the movie doesn't set up that Arthur will be okay if society cared about him. The world it sets up is relatable and bleak because we see rich people not caring for the less fortunate and governments failing the people. And there's an endless cycle of interactions with other people being failed by society that make life even worse. It has a lot of problems, but no real solutions. And that opens up a new can of worms because I don't know if a movie is responsible for giving solutions. When it's trying to tell the story. Plus, the perspective is undeniably Arthur's, and I think we have a bit of an unreliable narrator thing going on. I think there's some things that certainly the Zazie Beetz stuff is not happening, but I think during that interview with Thomas Wayne, there's some things that are just a little bit too over the top for that to actually be real. It reminds me a little bit of Pearl, where there's a point where Mia Goth does an audition and there's a judge who tells her, "We're looking for somebody prettier, blonder," which is more about something that's going on in her head than it really is. And in Joker, it's kind of like, "I have succeeded and you have not, and you are a terrible blight on society." And I feel like that's something that he's sort of inventing during all of this. And then ultimately, I think the story has just already been done. Obviously, the King of Comedy and Taxi Driver is all the way through this. Those are two superior movies. I don't think you're a Taxi Driver fan, though, are you?
I actually am. I actually of the kind of movies that explore this, it's one of a few that that I think is really smart about the way it portrays that that feeling. I much prefer Taxi Driver to this, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to look over the chat. There was a couple of pretty good points, I thought, in here. And I'm sorry if I mess up your handles, but I think it's Ama Diaho says, "My biggest problem with this movie for me is that this is one of those movies that's about society that focuses on one character, thus, as a result, succeeds in basically saying nothing about society. And that was something that I was sitting there trying to figure out the words to say about this, and that's perfectly put, I think. To focus only on Arthur and not to figure out what other people are going through and fighting through. I mean, yeah, there's a garbage strike that means 10,000 there's all this garbage everywhere, but we're not really getting the sense of other people who are hurting out there and what the sort of the chaos that creates when you have a large swath of people in a big city, especially all fighting for resources and that thing. And that is one thing. It's hard to focus a movie, I think, like this on a lot of different things, or it becomes a 3-hour movie, I guess. But I kind of felt that way too. It's like, it can't just be him that we're talking about here. And like I said, I don't know if the movie doesn't seem to prove without beyond a reasonable doubt that he would be okay if society was just better. I don't know if that's true or not, because he's got a lot of issues that he'd obviously be taken care of better. That's the best thing. But I don't know if he becomes a better person or anything like that.
I think the movie at least hints at a few moments of the way he connects with children. He talks about how much he loves the job at the hospital. Mm-hmm. He connects with the kid on the bus. He tries to do some of that stuff. It gives him, one of the worst scenes in the movie for me, but it does give him the grace to go, you were never mean to me, and, you know, to let the guy go or whatever. Like, I think it's like trying to plant a few of those seeds, but it,
yeah, you're right about that. He does have one very good skill, and he does know how to do that clown entertainment type mm-hmm. of stuff that can. And if it just wasn't for him getting in his own way or things happening to him that he feels like the only reason why he has a gun is because of the thing that happened to him with the sign spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And because he has that gun, he totally screws that job up when the gun falls out and everything. So, yeah, you're right. I think that there is one little seed there of that being a possible positive outlet for him. Were the infrastructure in place to take care of someone like him?
Yeah, I again think, unfortunately, when it's under the context of finding the origin story for a Batman villain, it all just kind of, you know, feels feels a little less important in that way. But yeah,
it feels like this could have been, this definitely needed to go a different way for sure. If you were going to make this the origin story of Joker, I think for sure.
I have two more points, mm-hmm. quick ones, before we get into the rest of the festivities. One is the way this movie treats its, cameos. I guess I'm going to call them cameos, because there are so many, like, and I'm not even talking about like Gary Goldman, who's a great stand-up comedian who, you know, mm-hmm. is just has part of his set, you know, in this movie or whatever. I'm talking about, like, you have Shea Whigham and Bill Camp as your cops, and they do nothing. They do nothing in this. Completely wasted. Like, mm-hmm. Mark Maron, also wasted, has like two mm-hmm. lines in this movie. You mentioned Byron Tyree Henry. Just like one scene with a couple lines. His whole job is to get a file and then try to keep it from being stolen. Like,
yeah, the Glenn Fleshler, who was the Yellow King and True Detective, and he's been in a ton of other, like, he's in Barry. That's another one that sort of gets wasted a little bit. He has a little bit more to do with the story than all those other ones that you mentioned. But like, just, you have these guys, use them to their fullest potential.
So that was an interesting through theme for me. The other thing I want just to address, I don't give a lot of credence to it, but I know some people believe that the unreliable narrator thing goes all the way to the end, and that the ending is not the truth of what happened. But I read that as pretty cut and dry, that he killed that social worker and is trying to escape from there. So I just thought I'd address it because I know enough people think there's some sort of dream narrative going on at the end where the entire thing was a dream. And he's
most of the things in the movie happen. It's just there's a few breaks from reality in it. And then, of course, whenever there's a few breaks from reality, then you start wondering if the whole thing is that. But I don't think the movie makes sense if some of the things that they're showing don't actually happen. Like, there's, you know, I don't know how you get to that point if the, you know.
And who knows, you know, Joker 4 in 2035 or, you know, whatever, the whole thing may be in a snow globe that Batman has on a shelf. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, you know, for now, we're dealing with a world that I think is supposed to be, you know, reality.
Oh, yeah. Joker 4 in 2035, where Joaquin Phoenix is like, he's the old Joker. He's trying to train the new Joker and everything. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. You have one more? Anything else?
No, I was just thinking that the sequel is fascinating to me on so many levels because I have no idea how you make a sequel to this movie. And, you know, of course you do because it made a ton of money. But
hey, man, it's going to be a while before Bruce becomes Batman. So he's got all these years to be Joker for a while.
Yeah,
so.
There you go.
All right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Okay. Yes, you mentioned some obvious great double features. You know, you could call them inspirations, or you could call them the page that Todd Phillips put the tracing paper over, whatever you want to call them. those are you mentioned The King of Comedy and Taxi Driver. Not going that route. I wanted to go with something, as is my want, that feels like a good spiritual combination. And I wanted to find one that felt to me like a better version of what I think this movie is trying to say and do. And so I went with Nightcrawler for this, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie.
This movie destroys Joker. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie is phenomenal, and I think is playing on that same playground, trying to do some of the same ideas of what happens when a culture forgets human decency and allows people who are mentally unstable to stoke that in different ways. Of course, in this case, it's about photography, you know, like accident photography and if it leads, it bleeds kind of mentality and how that affects our culture. Jake Gyllenhaal is phenomenal in it. Another incredible lead performance. And I think gives all of the disconcerting ugliness of Joker with also allowing us a deeper perspective and understanding of what it's trying to say. So yeah, I went with Nightcrawler.
Man, I want to see this movie right now. This movie's so good. It's really so is. Good. Like, there's not one bad moment in Nightcrawler. It's just outstanding.
Yeah.
All right. So you're going to continue this series. We're going to end it with this next week. And so, Aaron, what are we going to end this series with next week?
I have a feeling this will blow some people's minds that I didn't enjoy this movie. It is a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. It is a 8.3 on IMDb. It is a 100% on Metacritic. 100% on Metacritic because it is widely considered one of the greatest movies of all time that I just did. I was not in the right place when I watched this movie. And that is Lawrence of Arabia.
Ooh, baby.
This is, since it will be my final foray into this topic for the moment, I wanted to go out big, and I mean
I love this. I love the fact that this is a choice.
Because it also, I mean, it also feels like a movie we could have on Wreckatopia on a normal week. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's that widely considered amazing. I just didn't like it, and I'm going to figure out why that is. And I'm going to figure out what a moron I must have been the first time I watched this. That's the most likely outcome. However, it would be a really fun outcome if I watched it again and still didn't like it.
Yeah.
But
this is definitely the longest movie we've ever watched for Wreckatopia. I think it clocks in at 4 hours, if not just a little under, maybe. I don't know if it goes over it. I just recently got the 4K steelbook of this. Well, I guess it was last year when I got this. So this will give me a chance to watch it in that glorious format. I love this movie, so it will be interesting to see if you aren't turned around on it.
Then I'm kicked off the show.
Well, yes. Well, there's that. That goes without saying. But you know, can I, in the parting words to you as you leave, can I convince you that this movie is good by the time it's over? But I do believe, by the way, I do believe this is a movie that does require multiple viewings to enjoy. I think the first time you watch it, the length is daunting. And, you know, it's a movie that really is made for the big screen, too. So a lot of times you try to watch something like this on a home screen. Even though our home screens have gotten better over the years, that you kind of like don't see the majesty of it. I am excited about this, so that'll be next week. And once again, guys, this is gonna be the end of the show. Thank you, chat, once again for coming out here and watching us talk about movies. Very good discussion going on over there while we were talking about Joker. I can't wait to get into Lawrence of Arabia, but that is going to do it for this week. We will see you next time.
Catch you then, guys. Bye.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Do you ever do the thing where you just put several posters in the same frame? Just like stack them?
No, I've never done that.
I used to do that in college, actually. I'd get a new poster and I'd just stack it with the old one just because that kept the old one, you know, wrinkle free or whatever. And you can only do that so long, but it's a temporary solution for at least, you know, 5 posters or so.
Right. I have in the past debated on like getting just a whole bunch of frames and then just having all the posters that I have in frames, but that'd be impossible. There's too many to just do that. And then if I hung them up on the wall, I would run out of space there too. I don't want to have a whole home filled with just movie posters everywhere, 'cause that gets a little tacky.
I definitely have our downstairs area covered pretty well in pop culture artifacts. But there was a time a couple years ago where I just have a cardboard poster mailer that just when I get a poster that I'm like, because every year I'll get a bunch of posters for, you know, movies or whatever during award season. Mm-hmm. And if I get one that I'm like, oh, I want to keep this one, I'll just put it in there. And then a couple years ago, I actually went through everything in there and measured in case I wanted to frame them. And so I have this list of all the posters I had 2 years ago. It's changed since then. Have I updated it? No.
Mm-hmm.
but it's just like then the idea of like finding those sizes, putting them in, finding a place on the wall. It's just like, oh, the problems.
Yes.
The trauma of our lives, Chris. The trauma.
I know. I mean, what are we going to do? This is a big problem.
I saw the movie Long Legs. Have you seen Long Legs yet?
I haven't.
We can talk about it now, or maybe you can save it in case you want it to be a small recommend. It won't be a small recommend for me. I'm too mixed on it probably to throw it in that category. Plus, it's just not my genre. like straight satanic horror is just not, you know, something that like flips my switches.
Well, feel free to talk about it. I mean, whether or not it's a small recommend down the road, that's fine.
It's really interesting though, and you can tell one of the things I love about modern horror, quote unquote, is how technically well it's done, and how there are really great artists exploring this genre all the time. And so, it's clear that that's what we're dealing with here. It's always interesting to see Nicolas Cage just do an unhinged Nicolas Cage thing, which he's doing here, completely unrecognizable. In this, and I don't know, it's just, it strikes me as another timeline's darker Cable version of an X-Files pilot, if that makes sense. It's like the FBI investigating paranormal activity with a new FBI aide, like it, in the 90s even. So like it feels like all the jackets they're wearing and the badges, I'm like, oh, that reminds me of like the jackets and badges they wore in the X-Files for, you know, for the FBI or whatever. I wonder if some of that is intentional. Like, I wonder if this was somebody's X-Files spec script or something.
Certainly. I mean, who knows? It sounds like it kind of. Or just a big fan of the X-Files.
Right. Like, it feels like there's got to be something there. So yeah, I was interested all the way through. It's just hard for me to, A, enjoy a movie like this because it's not something I enjoy, or B, find my way to some sort of like positive outcome from, you know, watching a movie like this, other than just going, oh, that shot was cool. It's cool how they did that, you know, thing or whatever. But that's just, that's generally not enough for me. But for some people, I'm sure it will be, especially if you love horror. So I think I would definitely love to hear your opinions, when/if you see it.
I'm very interested in it. Once I get a chance to watch it, I will. I did go cause I was hanging out with my girlfriend and, wanting to figure out what to do for a couple of hours. So we went to the theater and I randomly picked Fly Me to the Moon because I figured that was a good little date movie type of thing.
It's clear that
I don't know if the people making movies realize what's good for theaters anymore and what's good for streaming anymore. Because Fly Me to the Moon feels like a streamer, like now that we've firmly entrenched in streaming movies and everything, this is something that feels like it's on Netflix or something like, or Hulu or something like that, and you're going through and like, okay, I want to catch up on The Bear and Fly Me to the Moon, what is that, you know, that's that kind of movie. It's like, it's perfectly fine, it's not bad, it's just not something that I need to go to a theater to watch, although I did, you know. And it's just one of those things where like, and it's in the, I didn't read into the background of this movie or whatever, but its conceit is that there was an attempt to fake the moon landing just in case something went wrong in the real moon landing. And I'm like, is this where we're going with this? Really? This movie? They actually, and of course, Woody Harrelson is the guy driving this too. Like, you can, that's like perfect casting. If you want to get somebody who's a conspiracy theorist or whatever, get Woody Harrelson. I bet Woody Harrelson believes this shit. This is probably like, you know, this is one of those type of things. But anyway, I mean, Scarlett Johansson is great, and Channing Tatum is great. Like, those are two attractive leads, and you would believe that they would fall in love with each other and all of that, but. Man, oh man, oh man. That's just one of those things where there's just nothing special about this at all.
Yeah, it's wild too, because then you look at like, and of course this is Netflix, so they're never going to go to theaters in the same way that other studios would like choose between their movies. Like Netflix isn't making a choice. They're just going, okay, we'll put it in theaters a week just in case it wins awards, but it's, you know, it's on Netflix. But you look at something like Axel F., that could have performed really well at the theater. Like, it's, you know, it's a big movie. There's action. It's a, you know, those Lega sequels are doing really well. I mean, Top Gun Maverick was like insane, you know, like It just feels like there's a possible, you know, $200, $300 million just laying there for Netflix that they're just like, yeah, nope, we want subscribers.
Right. I don't think I'll ever get this model. And I've always been very suspicious of it. Like I just believe that one day we're going to see some, like, you know, some major scandal out of one of these streamers who are like, you know, like, how did you make money all this time? Well, it turns out, you know, it's going to be something
like.
Have
you heard of Bernie Madoff?
Right, exactly. That's sort of where I'm headed. But, like, you know, it's just one of those, it's one of those things, like, why wouldn't you want, because they said that about Apple too, when Apple's coming out with movies on the big screen. And I believe, yeah, actually, now that I think about it, this would explain it. Fly Me to the Moon is an Apple movie. And so that would explain why it feels the way it does. You know, they came out with the grosses for that, and they're like, well, they're not too interested in what it makes in the theaters. Like, well, don't you want it to make a lot of money at the theater? Like, so that you don't have to worry about subscribers. Just, and I guess you're just looking for subscribers based on this one movie. How do you do that? I don't get that either. Like, oh, we're going to get the signups. Great. We're going to get the signups fast with this Fly Me to the Moon movie. I don't understand. Don't you want it to make a lot of money on its own before you put it on your service? I don't know.
Yeah, me either. I don't know why they do half the things they do. I'm like you. Netflix feels enough like a internet 2.0, you know, kind of business thing that 10 years from now, if it's like we were bankrupt the whole time and never had any money, and it's just like, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Because so much of, you know, modern wealth building is debt building, and it's such a weird thing to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just how it's how new school entrepreneurs see the world. Is like, it's not about how much money I'm earning. It's not about how much I'm providing money for other people. It's about how much I can leverage and, you know, and therefore have immediate wealth based on the leveraging of this debt or this thing or this idea or whatever. And then it just all goes away. So,
yeah. And there was an interview I caught with Jason Blum a couple of years ago, where he said that, you know, people who are going to Netflix get their money. Like, we're talking about producers here who are getting these big, huge deals. They get their money, and then after they get their money, there's really no real reason to make something good at that point, because you don't have that same pressure that someone coming out with a movie in a theater has, where it has to make a lot of money, because you've already made your money. So now you're just delivering a product. It literally is a product at that point.
Yep.
Where you're like, okay, we're going to make, I mean, case in point, the most cynical I can be about this is these Rebel Moon movies that came out.
Right.
Those movies are, you know, they're serviceable for what they promise. You know, it's basically when the lowly people rise up against the empire type movies, and so as long as you deliver that basic premise, you're fine. But yeah, like these guys, they come out with these series and these movies and everything. They don't really care about it being great, I don't think, or at least want to spend the time to make them great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all front loaded, and so it takes incentives. Incentives are a huge part of why a lot of things, you know, do well. You know, there is the other side of that, which is it also takes the notches down, or could notch down the mercenary aspect of it. In other words, like the idea of we have to make money, 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 or it's not going to do well, and so you sacrifice the art, you know, for the money. And there, I think there is something to be said for, you know, freeing people to do the art they want to do, And in some ways, Netflix has done that. You look at, you know, like Killers of the Flower Moon or Roma, for instance. Like, you look at Roma, like, I don't know Roma happens at a regular studio.
Yeah, that's the thing, though, right? So. You have to have a very special filmmaker who really is all about, they don't really, never really cared about money in their lives to go and do sort of a, you know, I want to make this good. And it's always these, I mean, no, and I'm still not a Killers of the Flower Moon fan, but
I know, yeah,
but it's exactly the kind of, I think it's exactly the movie Scorsese wanted to make, so so, you know, kudos to him for making it the way he wants and everything, but yeah, it's few and far between. You'd think that some of these guys would be like oh wow, I finally got a blank check to do whatever I want, all right, awesome, let's make this good and let's make this something lasting. And they're just not doing it.
Yeah. 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 For the most part, it feels like an 80-20 split, right? 80% just like, you know, hey, I can throw something up on the streaming service, you know, and 20% like, here's an auteur or an artist who is creating something special, like Roma or Maestro or, you know, whatever it might be. So, yeah, it doesn't feel like it's leaning that way.